Sounds as though something's happening now. Can you hear me at the back? I think that was a yes. First of all, let me thank Neil and the Institute for arranging for me to come for just one day, which is a bit of a shame, but I'm really very tight with all sorts of other things, and I think I'm very glad he was able to persuade me to come, because it's, what I've heard has been very interesting, and it gives a chance to talk about some things which I feel are appropriate for this meeting. Now, my transparency seems to have suddenly got out of order, so let me try and deal with that. Okay, I think this is it. Well, what I want to talk about is conformal cyclic cosmology, or perhaps conformally cyclic cosmology, as Paul Todd calls it, maybe more appropriately. But it has the initial CCC, so that's not easy to remember. Now, the first point about it is it crazy? Which, of course, can you see anything here? No, you can't. Why is that? Oh, there's a piece of paper behind it, that's why, where that came from. Okay. Is it crazy? And there's nothing wrong with it being crazy, of course. Yes, it is. But I would say that this applies probably to a lot of the ideas going around. And I think we need something crazy, so I don't think that's a negative. But it does, as well as being crazy, provide insights into various problems. Second law of thermodynamics, well, dark energy or the cosmological constant, dark matter. And I won't talk about all these things in any particular detail, but I will touch on all of them. Notice I put a cross at the end of inflation, because I'm going to say that this point of view does not involve inflation. It's an alternative to inflation. I suppose in some ways similar to Veneziano's ideas. I should say there is a correspondence, some relationship between Veneziano's and the Steinhardt-Turok ideas as well. So it has a context of other theories as well. But I'll say there is no eternal inflation. I want to say, to describe this theory, perhaps I'll tell you a few things that it's not, you see. It doesn't involve internal inflation, it doesn't involve ordinary inflation. There aren't any Boltzmann brains, or let's call them B brains, or D brains, or P brains. No strings, even. Certainly no extra dimensions, no instantons. Well, I was realizing when I was hearing some of the other talks that I should have added other things. No symmetry breaking, no bubbles, no tunneling, no anthropics, no landscape, and no ADSCFT. Not even any quantum gravity. And that one I think I deserve to put an exclamation mark, because I think people would think that if one's going to talk about the Big Bang, that's, in fact, I've argued this for decades, that this is a place where we need quantum gravity, and it's one of the reasons for doing quantum gravity. Well, I'm afraid I'm going to say no to that here in this talk. It only involves standard classical Einstein, well, cosmological constants there, greater than zero, general relativity. Well, with a slight extra twist, and I should reassure you that there's no twisters either. So, okay. Now, what is the scheme? The scheme does involve, first of all, a standard picture of cosmology. So in the normal way, I'll have space-time diagrams, time going up. So I'm going to run rather rapidly through the description of this scheme, because I haven't got time to say very much about it. But I want to talk mainly about some new things to do with the observations or the analysis of observations. Inflation might or might not be in this picture because it would be tucked in so closely in that corner that you wouldn't see it on the scale, but I'm saying it's not there in this picture. Of course, we do have black holes, so this is not the only singularity. We're also going to have singularities in black holes. And black holes do play a very important role in what I want to say. So that's a more complete picture of the sort of thing that I want to talk about. Now, there is a fundamental problem raised by the second law of thermodynamics, basically what Paul was relating to in his talk. Why did the Big Bang not involve any, well, it would be white hole, time reverse black hole singularities? This is the thing which didn't happen, and we have to see why. And it's not answered by inflation or by any current theory of quantum gravity. So it's a big issue, which is what the scheme I want to talk about is trying to address. So this is okay. I should also complete this picture a little bit so that the black holes don't last forever, as we know that we have this Hawking evaporation, and the picture is that eventually black holes will disappear with a pop. I should say, but call it a pop and not a bang, because it's not a really very big. Okay, it's about a reasonable size artillery shell going off, which is pretty trivial from the point of view of cosmology. And that's why it's not called a bang. And this is an awful long time. See, I can't get it on the screen, you'll notice. So, but it's a lot longer than that. For the biggest black holes that we believe are around, you have to think in terms of times like something like 10 to 100 years. So these black holes will be around for a long time. So let me, although this is definitely not to scale now, it was reasonably to scale before, but we have these things disappearing eventually. And then after that's what I call the very boring era. Before this, it was just boring. The most exciting things seem to be the disappearance of black holes, but that's pretty much of an anticlimax when you've waited maybe for a Google years, and then all it does is go off with a pop. This is the very boring era when you haven't even got that happening, which is one of the motivations for the scheme I want to describe, because I was really regarding it's so boring, and it just seems to me this universe of ours, which seems so exciting and interesting and so on and so forth, the fact that we should spend most of eternity just with this incredibly boring universe. But that's an emotional argument, I admit. But maybe emotional arguments have their place. I think they do. And I then began to think about, well, most of the particles around at this late stage will be photons. And it's very hard to bore a photon for two reasons. One is it probably doesn't have experiences. And the other is that, well, photons just go along the light cone and they don't experience the passage of time. I use this picture here because whereas the light cones are the most important part of space-time geometry, and here I have a sort of cartoon of all that, and if you want to explain general relativity or special relativity to somebody who doesn't know anything about it, it's useful to use a slide like this. This is most of the geometry, because it's the conformal geometry. The light cone's giving you the conformal structure, and per point, since I was saying I don't have extra dimensions, it's four-dimensional space-time. We therefore have 10 components to the metric. 9 of them, or when I read more correctly, the 9 ratios of the components are defining the light cone, and it's only one, which is the scale. So you almost have all the geometry when you have this picture. If you want all the geometry for Einstein's theory, you need to include these surfaces, which give you the times of ticks of identical clocks. And of course, we have very good clocks in nature, ultimately because of this fundamental relationship. Well, the two most fundamental formulae of 20th century physics, if you like, the Planck's E equals h nu and Einstein's E equals mc squared, which tell us that any massive particle is basically an oscillator whose rest mass is proportional to the frequency. So you have these fundamental clocks in nature. You can't very easily make a clock out of a single particle like that, but you could, when you've got lots of particles, the fact you've got a clock depends ultimately on rest mass. If you didn't have rest mass, and if the rest of the physics is conformally invariant, well, that's actually true as far as we know for everything except gravity. Well, gravity involves mass, so that the things which are not conformally invariant one way or another have basically to do with mass. In the case of gravity, it's the mass being the source. In the case of conformal breaking of physics, non-gravitational physics, it's the presence of rest mass, which seems to be what breaks the conformal invariance. When I say conformal invariance, I'm talking about Weyl invariance. So you have a scale factor which can depend on space-time location and Maxwell theory and the Yang-Mills equations have this conformal invariance in that sense. It's when you introduce rest mass that it breaks it. Now, if in the remote future you have something which is dominated by massless entities, you can think about this being basically conformal invariance being what's interesting, and we have this way of treating infinity, which has been around for many decades now, And it's just the space-time version of this familiar idea that if you take the Beltrami or Poincaré-Beltrami disk, you can, in a conformal representation, represent the entire infinite, this time a hyperbolic universe, as a finite, smooth boundary to the infinite space-time. And this is a conformal representation, so you have a nice, well-defined conformal geometry right up to and including including the boundary. So you have smoothness there. And you could anticipate, as a purely mathematical trick, extending this space-time geometry, well, here we have space-time now, beyond this smooth boundary. And this is a trick which has been going on for a long time. We've been using that for studying energy and gravitational radiation and so on, things like that. Now here you see, I'm assuming that if you wait an awful long time, the black holes disappear, and they disappear mainly in photons. So you have, again, lots of photons coming out of it. There is a little problem, though, that you might have rogue electrons, and electrons, you can imagine that protons might ultimately decay, and so on. You could imagine even that there is one massless neutrino. We know that the difference between the masses of the neutrinos are non-zero, but there could conceivably one which was zero. So you could imagine that if anything didn't have a charge, it might end up as something massless. This doesn't work for charged particles, unfortunately, because there aren't any charged particles around. They would muck up various things like pair annihilation and so on. So, yes? I beg your pardon? Well, they should evaporate away, too. The only case that you might worry about would be the critical case, because then the temperature goes to zero. But I think... Yes, that would be my view of the things, that they lose their angular momentum very quickly. Yeah. So, but it's only this critical case that would have a problem anyway, that you don't expect to get up to that in the case. So I don't think that's a serious problem. A much more serious problem are charged particles. So I do need to have something to deal to. If I really want this to be a strict rule, the strict philosophy that I want to adopt here is that this conformal boundary is something which is really there, in a sense, and that you can extend beyond that mathematically, and the idea is you can extend physically beyond it. So we have to do something with electrons and positrons. They won't always annihilate each other because they've got trapped in the horizons, and so you have these rogue particles which will be hanging around. So I have this hypothesis which some people regard as the weakest point of the theory. I think I probably agree with that. That is, you do need to have some mechanism where in the very, very long timescales we're talking about, and we are talking about long timescales, there will be a slow decay of mass itself. Not that particles decay into massless ones, but that the mass is not an absolute constant. And there is some rationale behind that because, in standard particle physics, you have rest mass as a Casimir operator of the Poincaré group. But if you have a cosmological constant, you could argue that that's not quite the right group to use, and that you should perhaps be using the de Sitter group, and then you find that the rest mass is not a Casimir operator of the de Sitter group. I'm not quite sure how strong that argument is, but it does suggest that there might be, in the very long timescales we're talking about here, some additional ingredient to particle physics where the rest mass of particles gradually decays away. And if there is a proportionality factor, which means that all rest masses decay away together in proportion, then it's a bit like saying that the gravitational constant gets weaker in the remote future. It's very similar to that. In fact, perhaps equivalent to it. But if they go to zero at different rates, then you can't encompass all that into a decaying away of the gravitational constant. But I do want the rest masses ultimately to disappear. Yes? I'm sorry, still, I'm not hearing something. Yes. Yes. It may be, let me perhaps, I'm not sure if I'm saying the same thing here, but if there's a bit of an irony here, you can say that isn't JR wonderful because you have this fundamental notion of mass, which gives you a fundamental frequency. But if mass decays away, then of course this doesn't give you the metric that Einstein would give you, and you might, as a finite boundary, or you might get a collapse, depending on the rate at which this goes away. And that may be similar to, I think, the things you're saying. Yes. Yes. Yeah. I think you could push the problem from one place to another. Yeah. Yes. Yes, no, I agree. I think that's probably another way of looking at it. And I imagine these things, you can look at it from one or another point of view. The metric that I would think of is really the one in which this picture, where you really do have this exponential expansion which goes on forever, the Einstein metric would be one in which you assume that the cosmological constant is actually a constant. I think if you take a metric where you use, say, these particles rather than the cosmological constant, then you might get a collapse. So that's... Yeah, I think there's a lot in common between what we're saying here. Well, if you like. It depends on your philosophy. I mean, you could say, well, there are not going to be many electrons around, and who cares? And that's not unreasonable. I'm just being a purist here, and I'd like to say, well, even the electrons must finally lose their mass in the asymptotic limit. But maybe that's a matter of taste. You might say you don't mind the little hole sitting in the finite boundary. Yeah. Yes, exactly. That's right. If you only got one electron sitting there, it'd be hard to, in practice, to build a clock. But well, there aren't any people around either to do it, so I'm not quite sure how the argument works. But anyway, let me just go on with the picture here. I don't want to spend too much time on this because I want to get on to other things. But this is the remote future. Now, we have to address the other problem, which is the one I started with, was this question of the state, the special initial state that this universe seems to have begun with. And for a long time, I've just been trying to understand this as a geometrical condition. I mean, how do you phrase geometrically what that state is like? And to say that the gravitational degrees of freedom are what seem to be suppressed in the early stages, and that does seem to be the case, how do you formulate that? Well, I've always put this in a form, say, the Weyl curvature hypothesis, which is to say that for some reason the Weyl curvature was constrained to be zero in the initial state. The trouble with this is it's kind of awkward mathematically, and there are lots of different versions of this because, after all, the Weyl tensor is a tensor, and when you've got a singularity, it's hard to say what you mean by a tensor, and so you're left with having to make statements like, well, the rate at which certain things go to zero is such and such, and there are lots of ways of saying that. But Paul Todd's proposal of saying, well, you can formulate a version of Weyl curvature hypothesis in the following way. You just say, well, you can stretch the Big Bang out by a conformal factor, and then the condition is that there is a smooth boundary to that, which is the Big Bang. This is not quite the same as saying the Weyl curvature is zero there. As far as it goes, it says simply that the Weyl curvature is finite on this boundary, or smooth and finite. We'll see that the condition I'm imposing is actually stronger than this, and it makes it zero. But the condition itself, that there should be a conformal extension beyond the Big Bang, is only forcing this to be finite. Now, in both these cases, one was just talking initially about a mathematical trick. This is a way of treating radiation mathematically. It's very handy. This is a way of stating the condition on the Big Bang, which might have been the one that was imposed in the early stages of our universe. Now, in each case, it's proposing that you could extend conformally these manifolds. And the extension in this case, as I say, there's this philosophy to say you can continue through, depends on there being just massless ingredients in this asymptotic limit. In the case of the Big Bang, in a certain sense, it's better founded, because what you have is a very, very high temperature, which gets higher and higher the closer you get to the Big Bang. And when you get earlier than, say, the Higgs mass or something like that, then you say that the mass becomes irrelevant, and the dynamics that's going on here is primarily the dynamics of massless entities. And in the limit, it would be the dynamics of massless entities. So you have effectively massless particles at the very beginning. Now, what I'm going to say here now is that in both cases, these mathematical tricks have a physical content. And so that the remote future of our universe, as we previously would have called it, I'm going to call it the eon that we live in, there will become the Big Bang of a future eon. And if there's nothing around here but massless entities, the physics in some sense is insensitive to the size. So the universe kind of forgets how big it is, if you like. Big and small become equivalent. That's a kind of cheap way of saying it. You really need some equations and things to explain how to describe all this. I'm not saying that this is the same. I mean, that this is not us again all over again. That's maybe the first most economical thing to think of. It does lead to certain problems, like these sort of grandfather paradoxes. And they're a bit more serious if you can actually observe in this eon what was going on in that one. And that's the sort of thing I do want to talk about. So let's not say that. What I am saying, well, first of all, this is the picture for just one eon. This is our eon. And I'm saying that the remote future can be described as a finite conformal boundary. And first of all, I should have explained what this is going on at the back, because I've had that picture. At the end of one of my talks, somebody said, why does the universe have a hole in it at the back? And I said, well, the point about this is that I just don't want to be prejudiced as to whether the universe is actually open or closed. It doesn't seem to make any difference in this discussion. If it happens to be flat on the whole, there is another ingredient which can come in, which I don't want to make use of anyway. So it could well be either open or closed. It could be hyperbolic in the large, or it could be closed in the large, or it could be flat in the large. And this stuff at the back is just to say I'm not going to prejudice the issue here. Now, here we have the squashing down of infinity, and here we have the stretching out of the Big Bang. And this is a statement of what the Big Bang was like. It's a very strong statement, which is saying that the universe has to have been such that there were no white hole degrees of freedom in the initial state, or in some form of Weyl curvature hypothesis happens to hold here. The Weyl curvature, it turns out, in the remote future, necessarily becomes zero on this boundary. This is a crucial part of the whole description, and perhaps I'll make a comment about that now, if you like. When one was studying, electromagnetic radiation, you find that because of the conformal invariance of Maxwell's theory, the electromagnetic field has finite values on this boundary. And if you want to match it to something on the other side, you want finite values of this electromagnetic field at the initial boundary also. With regard to gravitation, the thing which has a finite boundary here is the Weyl curvature, but scaled with a different conformal factor from the way that the actual Weyl tensor scales. And that does become finite at the boundary, just the same way as the way Maxwell field gets finite at the boundary. But because of the scale factor being different from the way that the Weyl curvature scales, you find that the Weyl curvature automatically goes to zero at that boundary. So there has to be a zero Weyl curvature at this boundary. Now, if you're going to match this with another eon, so I'm saying, I don't want to call it an epoch, because epochs are things which, you know, one talks about different stages of evolution within the universe. This is something on a much grander scale. So I'm calling this an eon, and this is our eon, and that our remote future will be conformally identical, or will join conformally smoothly onto the Big Bang of a future eon. There was, in this scheme, an eon prior to ours, and its remote future joined conformally, smoothly, onto our Big Bang. And because the vowel curvature necessarily goes to zero because of the scaling property, it means that the vowel curvature, in order for this conformal geometry to be smooth, the vowel curvature has to actually be zero in the Big Bang. So that is a consequence of this idea. Now, that's then the proposal. The origin of extremely low entropy is part of this, and the detailed departures from uniformity will come about because you have departures from uniformity here, which will propagate through on the other side. This is what I refer to as conformal cyclic cosmology, or perhaps conformally cyclic cosmology. And the claim is that both the evolutions come from classical equations. So this is the outrageous thing, if you like. Many of the things I was saying this thing doesn't use, well, perhaps that's not particularly outrageous, but not to use quantum gravity, you might say, is outrageous. And I would say, you will say, surely, that near the Big Bang, space-time radius curvature will get down to the Planck length, and so quantum foam, space-time chaos, discrete space-times, non-commutative geometry, etc., should come in. And this is what all my friends working on quantum gravity would have said. And I say here, and I would have said it too before this scheme presented itself, I would say that it can't have been like this because extremely low entropy conformally smooth Big Bang would not have arisen because there are all these other possibilities, and why did they not contribute to the initial state? That's a great big puzzle. So it's basically the thing that Paul was talking about shortly a while ago. The vowel curvature hypothesis tells that it's the radii vowel curvature, that's the point I'm trying to make, which would you need to get down to. So I'm saying that having very large curvatures, where radii of large curvatures approach the Planck scale, is not a reason for having quantum gravity unless it's the vowel curvature, which becomes very, very large. So that's the point of view I'm adopting here. And then I lose some friends, but I gain others, because my friends who work on classical differential, partial differential equations and all that, they're all very pleased because there's another area in which they can apply their equations. I'll say a little bit more about that later. I think I should make a quick comment about the obvious issue, which may be raised here, that the entropy is surely increasing here and increasing here, and how could you have a cyclic type universe where the entropy seems to be going up all the time? Well, my answer is very similar, I think, to what Paul was saying a short while ago, but I want to put it in slightly different terms. And this is the question of what we mean by entropy that comes in here. And I'm using a Boltzmann definition of entropy. You've got some phase space. You might say, well, the phase space is infinite and so on. It might be infinite. I don't believe, a critical issue. If the universe is infinite, you can look at a sort of co-moving portion of it, and that's more or less what one does here. Let's not worry about the infinite issue, because I don't think that is the point. But you do have a Boltzmann definition, which means that you coarse-grain this thing, and then you, that's maybe the reason we're in now, the volume of that region, the logarithm of that gives you the entropy. Now, an important point of this, of course, is logarithms have this property of multiplication of volumes goes to addition of logs, so the entropy is additive for independent systems. Okay, that's not a big puzzle, but what happens when you have black holes that are evaporating? Well, there's this issue of the information loss paradox, and I'm definitely siding with what appears normally to be the minority here, namely that black holes do evaporate and lose information. Let me put that up here. Second law of thermodynamics, how can that be squared with a cyclic universe? Information, i.e. phase space volume, gets lost in black hole singularities. That's what I'm saying. This agrees with the old Hawking, and it disagrees with, it agrees with the Hawking of long ago and disagrees with the Hawking of more recent years. The phase, which either way you can agree with Hawking one way or the other. That's the advantage of this. The idea then is that if you lose information, what that really means is that you lose phase space volume. And this does introduce a new factor into our understanding of physics. It's not as though the evolution is non-Liouville. It's that you lose part of the phase space. And that's, of course, not the usual way we look at phase space. I mean, usually we think about phase space as something out there, and your dynamics is described by a curve in the phase space. But if somewhere along that dynamical procedure you have to say, well, you've lost degrees of freedom, that means your phase space flattens out. It's really, it becomes a factor space, because the degrees of freedom in the black hole get lost, and so your track through the phase space gets flattened into this smaller region. I don't really want to go into this in any detail, because it will distract from the rest of it. I can imagine there are all sorts of arguments people would have, and I would prefer if that would be at least delayed till the question time, if not further than that, because that's not what I want to talk about here. My own view is that it does make sense of the whole thing. You're losing a huge, if this is the internal degrees of freedom that are lost in the black hole, and these are the rest of the universe degrees of freedom, then this effect gets subtracted. And this can be absolutely huge, you see. And because it's a collapsing of your factor space, of your phase space, and because of the log formula here, it means that you renormalize your entropy value by subtracting a big number from it. So it never really violates the second law, but it transcends it. So that somehow the actual second law, as far as the external world is concerned, plugs along in its usual way. But if you want to have a measure of the entropy of the whole universe, you need to take into account those degrees of freedom which are lost in the black holes. And this is how the whole scheme makes sense, and makes consistent sense, that the, not actually at the crossover, but somewhere a little bit before crossover, the entropy has to be renormalized to a value which makes it smoothly go across from one to the other. I should make the point, incidentally, that the phase space is conformally invariant, because you have dp dx's it's made out of, and as the p goes one way, the x goes the other way, and so that's an invariant under the conformal rescalings. So that's okay. That's the general picture. I did want to say very rapidly something about the equations, but it's not mainly, again, what I want to talk about, so let me do it very quickly. But just to give you an idea of the sort of thing one does, the way one treats this is to have, here this is the crossover surface, that's the remote future, the purple one, of the previous eon. This is the Big Bang of the next, and the universe eon coming after that. I use this notation of the circumflex, or the hat, for the, you have, the mnemonic is to think of the light cone, you see, in the point which points downwards, that gives the circumflex, and the inverted hat the other way around is for the succeeding eon. And what I'm going to suppose is that Einstein's equations with cosmological constant hold here, and also here. The cosmological constant is taken to be an actual constant. If it does in some sense vary, I would want to transfer that variation to other parameters. Another way of saying this is, rather than using Planck units, where you take the gravitational constant as equal to 1, what I would do would be to take, okay, speed of light is 1, Planck's constant is 2 pi, and the cosmological constant is 3. And those are my units that I would use. I'm not going to use them here, but you might ask why 3. I'll come to that in a minute. But it seems to be the natural number if you're going to make your units based on the cosmological constant. And the whole scheme depends on there being a positive cosmological constant, I should say, because that's what makes infinity space-like. And the Big Bang has to be space-like, but the remote future could have been something else. Say if it was negative, this would be a time-like surface. If it's 0, it would be a null surface. And those ones don't match. So if you want it to match, you have to have a positive cosmological constant. And once it's positive, that means you could rescale your physics so that it's 3. And that's perfectly consistent, as far as I can see. OK, then you write down the Einstein equations for both sides with the same lambda. And then the omega is the scale factor before, which goes to infinity as you get to the boundary. The little omega is the one that's small. That goes to 0 as you get to the boundary. So big omega is big, little omega is small. That's a good mnemonic, too. And the lambda here. I should say that there is a feature of this which I didn't expect at first, and that is that you have... I'm going to suppose, I should say, in this description, that the trace of the energy momentum tensor is 0 right up to here. Now, in the actual picture that I have, you might expect it to tail off to 0 in some asymptotic limit. But this, since I don't know how it would tail off, I'm going to suppose as an approximation that it's actually put to zero at this, at least within this bandage which covers the two and joins the two pieces together. I should say that the G without the hat or the inverted circumflex is supposed to be an artificial metric, if you like, which patches together between the two and which is completely smooth as you go across. So that's the way you treat the mathematics. And I shall only be extremely rapid in saying this here. Here we have, I want there to be a cosmological constant in the sense that here we have the, if you have pre-crossover, no trace to the energy momentum tensor, then you have the Ricci tensor with the hat is equal to 4 times the lambda. And if you have on the crossover bandage, I want to impose the same condition. What you find on the other side is that it actually isn't quite that. You have to have the appearance of rest mass, which does occur here automatically. This is one thing which happens in the scheme. Now, the equation, in order to ensure this condition here, that this conformal factor satisfies, is a solution which I'm calling the Pomiga equation. This is, I think, a Cambridge terminology for that pi, which is a curly pi, or I'm calling it Pomiga. Now, this Pomiga equation is what I've written down here. It's a self-coupled, conformally invariant scalar wave equation, and that's what the conformal factor satisfies. Conformal factor is a particular solution of that equation. There is also, for this equation, an energy momentum tensor, which is this thing I've written down here. It sometimes was referred to as the new improved energy momentum tensor, which Callan, Coleman, and Yakif introduced, although Ted Newman and I had it in a paper a couple of years earlier, that they were actually using it. We just commented on it. And you can write down this energy momentum tensor like this. And the Einstein equations in the pre-Big Bang phase turn out to be this, that the energy momentum tensor of the matter down here scaled according to this, which preserves the divergence equation. The energy tensor of the matter is equal to the energy momentum tensor of this omega, which I'm calling a phantom field. I know that people use that term for other things, but here I mean that it's simply the conformal factor. It's not really there, in a sense, because it's only telling you how to scale back to the Einstein metric, the metric with the hat on it. And if you're trying to represent Einstein's equations in this metric, this is it. And it's quite remarkable in a way that it has such a simple form. Now, I want to introduce what I call the reciprocal hypothesis. You need to nail things down a bit in order to make this a unique metric. This is the idea, in order to get the propagation unique. And I nail it down, first of all, by saying that what I'm calling the reciprocal hypothesis, that the capital omega and the little omega are related to each other by one being minus the inverse of the other. I don't quite see where I've written it down, but maybe you can see it somewhere. It should have been written on one of these transparencies. But anyway, that's what it is. Little omega is minus the inverse of the big omega. Oh, I can see it on here. That's the reciprocal hypothesis. Okay, so that fixes things to some degree. There is, however, still a freedom, which is this equation which I've got written down here. And so you want to fix that freedom. And what I do, 2 points quickly. One is that the energy momentum tensor after the Big Bang, you have not just the fields that were around before, but suddenly this thing with the phantom field, because your conformal factor has now become its inverse, it transforms like a real field. So I'm saying that there is a scalar field which appears necessarily after the Big Bang just by virtue of the condition here that you have the conformal factor turning into minus its reciprocal. And that is what I'm calling the initial form of dark matter. I was a little bit worried for a while on this because it looks as though each time you go through a transition, thank you, you have a crossover, you have a new dark matter appearing, and that perhaps it would just pile up and pile up and pile up. But I was hearing recently about certain observations, although maybe they're not very well confirmed at the moment, that it's at least conceivable that dark matter has a very slow decay rate into electrons and positrons. I'd be only too pleased if that happened, and I want to get rid of it all by the time you cross over into the next eon. So that's the sort of thing. Of course, I'm only pleased if the electrons lose their mass, of course. But that would be the picture. And then you get a whole lot of new initial form of dark matter. It would initially be massless, but what you notice from these equations is that you actually pick up a trace to the energy momentum tensor automatically just by virtue of the equations. And that trace has this curious form here. Now, I want to say something about that because it involves a term which I've written there, 3 lambda pi pi minus lambda, where pi is this thing here. Now, that's a very useful object. It remains finite at crossover, and it can be described in terms of the big omega or the little omega, whichever you prefer, and it's a very good way of keeping track of the conformal factor as you cross the crossover. But it's a perfectly finite quantity, and you can describe your physics in terms of this pi object. Now, the final thing I wanted to say here is that the condition that I impose to make the crossover dynamics unique is this thing here. If lambda were equal to 3, it's telling you that this is a unit vector at the crossover. And what I want to say is that not only is it at the unit vector crossover, which is automatic, but its first and second derivatives are also, well, let's see, I'm saying that this is of order omega cubed, so that it means what's the first and second and the third derivatives. The second derivative is certainly 0, yeah. Second derivative is 0, so that means that you get two conditions on this thing, and it seems to be enough to fix this metric unique, and it gives a dynamics across from one side to the other which looks as though it is absolutely deterministic and well-defined. So those are the equations, and they're definite equations, and of course one might choose a different thing from this, but this seems to me to look like the most likely condition to impose, partly because it is the quantity, this thing here is the quantity which you want to make zero if you want your rest mass to stay zero for as long as possible. Now, there is something about presumably the Higgs mechanism coming in and symmetry breaking coming in and so on because of conformal anomalies and so on. I imagine that will happen. Let me leave all that and talk about the observations, because that's really what I want to talk about. Okay, what are the observational consequences of this scheme? Well, it seemed to me that there are several things you might argue for. The most obvious one, and probably the most evident effect, as far as I can see anyway, would be the following. This is our eon. This is the crossover surface. This is the eon before ours. Every now and again, within a cluster of galaxies, you will have galaxies colliding with each other. Every now and again, those galaxies' collisions will result in the black holes in their centers getting too close, maybe capturing each other, and in swallowing each other up, there will be a tremendous burst of gravitational radiation, carrying away a significant proportion of the total energy in those two black holes, maybe a few percent. I don't know what the current estimate is on that total energy. There's a problem when you talk about energy. Let me just say there's a problem. I have some suggestions about how to deal with this problem. The problem is that we have an infinity which is space-like and not null, and all the work that I know of that treats the Bondi mass, the Bondi-Sachs mass, and the definition of energy loss and so on and so forth has to do with, is worked in an asymptotically flat space. So one has to start all over again and do it for a space-time which is asymptotically de Sitter. And I have some suggestions on that, and I wrote an article in honor of Josh Goldberg, which put some proposals as to how to deal with energy here. Anyway, I just want to mention there is a problem, but I'm going to talk as though there were no problem. So let's talk about this energy which comes out from this impulse, or from this swallowing of black holes here. This, if you follow the equations, you see what happens is that this gravitational wave converts itself on the other side into derivatives of this omega field, if you like, which is what I'm regarding as the initial form of dark matter. that initial form of dark matter, which starts off massless and then it acquires a mass with the idea, is is given a kick in the outward direction, which carries the energy of that gravitational wave impulse outwards like this. So we will have that this initial dark matter is given a kick, and that we might be able to see that. Now, you see, these various things are more or less spheres here, and you have our back sphere here, which is our CMB, if you like, surface, the sky, CMB sky, and the intersection of these spheres will be a circle. So what you would see would be a circle. And the picture I have, that it's something like a pattern of ripples on a pond, and after a while they disappear because the Hawking evaporation gets rid of all the black holes, and you would just see just something which looks fairly random. But a number of features would be that you could maybe single out these things. I have here a key part of this argument is that you will probably, if you do have a black hole in a galactic cluster, the clusters will remain bound, at least in the ordinary dynamics. You may lose a few galaxies now and again through chaotic dynamics. Or if the rest mass finally decays away, then they will eventually disperse. But the idea is that for quite a long time, these black hole clusters, these galactic clusters will hang together, and that you will have galactic, you will have black hole collisions within that cluster many times. One particular black hole will undoubtedly swallow others, and so you'll have several bursts, and these would look like concentric circles. So it's not simply that you have circles in the sky, but you have centric ones. Now, initially, I was thinking of looking for these circles in terms of a temperature, which might be a little more, a little less than the average, but Vahe Gazajan pointed out that a better way of looking at them is to look at the variance around these circles. The thing is, you don't quite know what dominates the temperature overall, but the fact that this should have a low variance over the circle is perhaps a good diagnostic test. But it's really, we're looking at the CMB. I can't get this on here. Well, that's probably the best way, isn't it? I should put it the right way around, which is, I think, that way. It doesn't really matter which way I put it, does it? Okay, that's the sky. And everything we're looking for should be in this picture. Well, I guess Planck will have a better picture, but all we have available is the WMAP picture. And there maybe is some question about what it means in the middle here. That is certainly an issue. Now, the initial analysis that Vahe was doing was there is an issue which has been a great argument about. I don't want to go into that argument because I think we can circumvent it. The question is, okay, you may find some circles here which seem to have low variance. How many fingers is that? Two. Oh, gosh, I better speed up. Low variance, but the question is, what should you expect? And the question, you have to compare it with a random simulation. And Vahe's original simulations were not approved of by many people. So I should say, everything I'm going to say here is using the standard conventional simulations which use the power spectrum that everybody else puts in. You can argue against it if you like, but I don't care for the purposes of this discussion. Everything I'm saying here will be looking at the standard ways that people do their simulations. Now, the thing that he looked at recently was not just individual circles, but points which are the centers of at least three rings. So you're looking at bursts of occur at least three times. So the thing is that if you look for individual circles, you find rather a lot of them anyway in the when you put the power spectrum in, and you tend to see lots of them, and so it's not a very good test. However, if you look for triples, three with the same center, this is the map that he came up with. And these are the actual rings. And you can compare that, I suppose, with the actual cosmic background here. It's curious how non-random they look. You have great crowded regions like this one, and another one up there, another one on the edge here, and a lot of sort of rather vacant regions like this here. A region excluding the galactic plane is the middle part. You don't see anything because that's where the galactic plane and a good region around it has been removed. So that's just an unknown, what's happening there. Now, is this, how unlikely is this? Okay, well, using the kind of simulations, using the power spectrum that other people do, you find not the 352 points, you see these are the centers over here, and these are the actual circles. 352 centers are found in the actual CMB sky. Simulation, he found 79. It's a little bit miserable compared with this here. Then he pointed out to me that actually this isn't quite what everybody does, because it doesn't include this thing called the overlapping noise or something. You have to put in some random noise as well. And what happens when you do that? Well, you put that in and you find fewer circles, only 47 centers. I think that's the same simulation as this one, but we're putting the noise in. Only 47 centers. Okay, well, that's looking fairly encouraging. In fact, he's done it again with three different simulations. He actually did, well, let me show you another picture where these are a bit bigger, so I'll leave the big one up. That's the true data. And these are three different, randomly chosen out of 10 simulations. And for these, you find 47 centers, 19 and 12. And this is a pretty miserable one, these. In fact, the average number of centers for 10 independent simulations was 15. I think it was just under 15. So it's looking as though the simulations simply don't give you the number of centers that one actually sees in the true data. Since I'm practically run out of time, I won't even try to describe. This is putting the... I think just showing the pictures is probably the most impressive thing to do here. He also looked at four rings. So what happens when you look for four rings? Now, this is the true WMAP data. You still see quite a few. In fact, you see 56 centers, which is more than in the simulated data's the maximum number where you look for three rings. So, and these are the centers. He's also, I don't know whether you could see it, but he's actually put the colors. The colors are the indication of the average temperatures. So here we have high temperature and low temperature down there. And you see that there is a tendency for the ones in this region in particular, where there's an awful lot of them going on, there's a big puzzle. What is this? Why are they so crowded? Is there really a huge thing out there somewhere in which there are just enormous numbers of these black holes, greater density? For some reason, the black holes are more likely to hit each other or something or other, or they're bigger black holes or whatever it is. And this is why you see a lot of crowding there. Or is it something else, which is what I had initially thought, that maybe the pattern is more uniform over the sky, but you simply don't see them in many regions because of irregularities in our eon primarily, which would cause the circles to become lensed. So they're not quite circles. And if they're not quite circles, they will become invisible to the algorithm. So it may well be that there are circles in other places, but they are not seen because they are not quite circles. But when he produced this picture, I began to wonder a bit about this, because you do see that the temperatures are very much correlated. Now, this really means that what you're looking at are things which, well, we don't know what it means, but there is the question of the angle in which, can I just take a moment to describe this, because this is the last thing I want to say here, but there is a question which I've thought about for quite a while, and I'm not quite sure what the answer to this is. Here we have a conformal picture of us, and this is our infinity, and that's our Big Bang. This is a corrected picture. Paul Todd had originally estimated that we were about two-thirds of the way up here. I now have independent information, Paul's new estimate, and those given by Nelson and Williams. I forget the names of these people. The moment. I have it to the bottom of one of my slides, but I've lost track of which one it is. Okay. Anyway, it does seem that we're probably about three quarters of the way up. Now, what does that mean? Suppose the previous eon was like ours, and so the black holes didn't start to collide much before us now. They're probably doing it round about now. I think there's some indication of a couple of black holes which look as though they will collide about now. That probably means in several million years, but that's now the point of this picture. But let's suppose that they start to come round about now. So you'll have a picture like this where nothing much happens before about a quarter of the way up. Now, if you compare the sizes of these with the, I mean, what kinds of sizes of circles would you get? You find there is a maximum ring limit. Yeah, here we are. Nelson and Ewing, Wilson Ewing and Todd were the two people. And they say, well, Paul says 20 degrees. They were saying something slightly less. But it seems to me that if we are a quarter of the way up, and that was what they seem to agree on, the maximum ring radius is 20 degrees. That means we, if this is a correct mechanism, this is, if this is what we're really seeing, we shouldn't see rings larger than 20 degrees. Now, what do we see? And here is the picture again of what we actually see. And if you look at the biggest rings in this picture, they're about 18 degrees. They're about 18 degrees radius. So it's consistent with this observation that they shouldn't be happening before about now, in the previous eon. If the previous eon was generally like ours, and further point is that there isn't a stretching which between one eon and the next, which is the simplest assumption. So there's a consistency with the point of view that this is what's going on, and moreover, that the eon prior to ours is in general terms similar to ours. It could have been very different, that these circles had different sizes and so on, but it does seem to be that they were similar to ours, and that there wasn't any big stretching factor between this and this. So I think I'll just leave you with that. Thank you very much.
So I'll make the comment which you know I always make in this talk, which is you've put in the arrow of time by hand, by what you do with the phase space, by this phase space removal that only happens in one direction.
Let me comment on that, but go ahead, yes.
Well, that's just a comment that you have done that.
Well, you see, there's a different philosophy, I think, which arises from this point of view, which is a bit like steady state model in the old days, where there may be some various things which look coincidental, and whether the time arrow is consistent over the whole picture, and maybe it's one way, one place, and another way, another place, is a possibility. But this sort of picture is saying that what you really look for is things which propagate. And, okay, this is a consistent picture. It keeps going one way once it's got going, because the black holes, you don't get white holes, so you only get black holes. So that means that the loss of information, if you like, is only in one direction, and that that compensates for the entropy increase here. And so once it's sort of set up, it just keeps on going. So, I wouldn't say, you could say that the dynamics, I'm not sure that this is true. It may be there is a time asymmetry right in the fundamental physics here, but I'm not sure it needs it. That's the only
I think it does, but anyway.
So it seems like if you have these regions which are creating these it's an over-density, right? So in where you have the rings, there's a big fat
active
ring.
Regions.
So if I just, let's say I just go out to infinite time, it would seem like that those regions would create more over-density, more galaxy, more black holes, and you get more and more rings as time goes on. And so then you wouldn't have sort of small perturbations on a long time scale.
Well, that's
but
a good
they
question.
Would, they would sort of
a bit related
build up.
To the other one. I mean, the question, as I say, does that happen, or does it self-propagate? You see, if you're adopting the steady-state philosophy, which I say I was brought up on a long time ago, which, of course, is discredited because we don't have a steady-state model, but the ideas underlying that were that you look for things that propagate. Now, the suggestion would be that the irregularities settle into a certain degree of irregularity which propagates. And so we'll have to see if that's the case or not. Or does it do what you say? I forget which way around you were saying it, but whichever way.
I'm just saying if you took this back one time previous, let's say you went back one, you don't call an epoch, you call it, what did it call, an eon or something?
Well, it could smooth out, or it
but
could
if
get
you
more
went
clumpy.
Back to the previous one, I'm saying that you would have had those rings would then produce more rings in the next
what?
Time.
Sorry.
So that the regions, the fact that you have these rings, in those regions you have an overdensity.
Rings,
right?
Yes.
So in those regions you're going to produce more galaxies than you would otherwise. And in those galaxies then you make more black holes. And so the next time around they would be amplified, right? Because every time you go through those
it's
regions
not obvious
produce more
to
and
me.
More.
I mean, because you certainly get this propagation, you see, effects. I mean, it needs being looked at carefully. I just don't know the answer to that. I mean, is it true, and it might be the case, what you say, that the thing tends to clump more and more as time goes on? I'm not convinced about that. It may be that...
But it would seem that as the future goes on, those regions would make rings, right? So the next universe would have more rings than this universe. That's what it would seem like. Yeah.
Well, of course, the rings themselves aren't a big factor. I mean, they're the big observational factor because they're very abrupt. The reason that I say look for the rings is because you've got a thin shell coming out, which is an impulsive thing. And so something that you would look at and see. However, that's only a small proportion of the amount of mass there. A much bigger effect, surprisingly enough, if you just think about the black holes, is the Hawking evaporation. Because the entire mass of that black hole ultimately goes into photons, practically the whole mass, goes into photons, which is spread out with a certain distribution. Okay, that'll be a signal which maybe one could see here.
Maybe I should just take this offline. But my last statement would be, is I thought you said that those rings are due to the fact that you are compressing the dark matter, right? You said that the dark matter is sort of responding to this gravitational waves, so that the dark matter now has this... There's regions of higher density, yeah. And those regions will collapse to form galaxies. So you really...
But they're not due to the rings themselves. That's just the temperature. I mean, it's complicated, yeah. I'm not saying that the rings themselves are energetically a big part of it. I'm just saying that the energy is very localized. In these rings.
Sure, but a small perturbation leads to galaxies, right? So that's...
Yes, okay. You do have large regions which are empty.
But the reason, if you have the CMB, the perturbations you see in the CMB lead to the formation of galaxies. So if you're creating perturbation on the order of the CMB, those perturbations will lead to galaxies in the long-term time scale. So it would seem that if this thing is actually leading to structure formation...
But there'll still be a lot of dark matter. I mean, what's the view? I mean, are there big voids full of dark matter which hasn't condensed, or are they really voids?
They're voids.
Sorry?
I think they're voids.
Well, that's a good question.
I do some astrophysics, so I'll say that, yeah. I mean, that's the... If you take cold dark matter scenario seriously... Yeah. Then there are genuine voids out there. There's still a lot of dark matter in the universe, but a lot of dark matter now is in structure these days. In the long time scale, most of the dark matter will go into structure. A lot of dark matter will go into structure. So voids, relative to speaking to the average density of the universe, you just took out the average density. A void is a void. The average density.
Voids are really voids, is the statement.
Yes.
Well, something will propagate there because you will certainly get. Certainly the photon, you see, but then the photons go with the speed of light, so they don't necessarily remain in the same area. So I'm not sure. You see, it's not obvious that, big clumps go to big clumps, because there is a spreading. Certainly if galactic clusters finally evaporate, then they will spread out too.
I'm just saying if you affect the...
Yeah. I'm just saying I don't know the answer. Yes.
So in this model, each eon has less phase space than the previous one?
No. The idea is that the phase space gets factored down when the black holes disappear. But after crossover, you now have available all those gravitational degrees of freedom. And so that's why the entropy looks so low, because you're now changing your mind and say, well, now that phase space allows the gravitational degrees of freedom, and then it's a very small region in that phase space.
So it's effectively regenerated, renormalized at each eon.
Yeah. It sort of goes to a factor space, and then it goes to a subspace. So it goes through that transition all the way through. And so I don't think there's any trend. I think it's something which you could see as something which propagates. There is a good question here, and I've rather maybe swung around to the view previously thinking that maybe the voids in this picture here were where there was lensing, and so the algorithm was blind to seeing the circles. But since you find in these pictures, I had my four center ones, but you find that they're actually the average temperature of the rings in here is generally higher. You get cold regions and hot regions with lots of rings. So it's not just the fact that it's hot here and cold here, because you get lots of rings here and you get lots of rings here too. Many more here, but still lots there. And so I tend to think that this is probably a near huge region, which is causing the rings, but cold, and that one is a distant huge region, even huger region, and it looks hot because the impact is coming towards us, whereas these look cold because you're seeing the impact going away from us. So you have to worry about that geometry. And it, because the temperatures over here seem to be all, not all, but the tendency for them all to be rather similar, that gives you a measure of how far away the source is you're looking at. I'm not convinced about that because there could be other reasons. But that would tend to suggest that this really is a big localized region. Well, I say localized, it's absolutely enormous, but localized in this picture here, and localized in the space-time, and that there's another localized region here, but this one is a close one and that's a far one. That's possible. Maybe there's some other explanation.
So maybe before we thank the speaker one last time, can I remind you again, before running off to lunch, if you could all come and quickly come out in the hall for a group photo, and then let's thank Roger Penrose one last time.